To your Committee on Rules, it's April 27th. The time is flying quickly. We have about 4 weeks left for policy bills in the Senate and in the House as well. And we're still struggling to find a time for Senate rules to meet, so I appreciate everybody juggling schedules. I would like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 685. Ms. Taylor, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill, and Senator Przanski, come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 685 allows a voter at a primary election to write in the name of a candidate for an office listed on that ballot who's not affiliated with a major political party. In your packet, not only do you have this brief staff measure summary, however, you also have a visual aid from Senator Przanski's office.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Floyd Przanski, State Senator, District 4. With me today is Greg Fox. Mr. Fox is a constituent, and I guess the best way I can recall this is at one point Mr. Fox and I were talking during the last ballot campaign season, and he was expressing frustration to me as a Democrat and wanting to be able to have the opportunity to participate as a Democrat in the primary process, but at the same time be able in certain cases to be able to exercise his right to vote for someone that may not be on the Democratic primary, and not for a write-in perspective of a new person to be the Democratic nominee, but for someone else who may be such as a third-party candidate. During that discussion, we spent some time as to trying to figure out what might be an option or opportunities to allow major party members to have that ability. And what we've put in your packet today is a sample of what a ballot could look like. Now, the bill that you have before you, Senate Bill 685, I understand in speaking with Annette Newingham, who will be one of your witnesses today. She is the Lane County clerk and does all of the elections in Lane County. She and I spoke earlier today as to some of the concerns they have, and I'll let her share those as to the prospect of how this would actually play out and the cost and the logistics of making something like this happen. The bill itself may not read the way that we have intended to carry this forward, and so we understand in speaking with her, also my discussion with legislative counsel, that we may need to make some changes. We asked the legislative counsel for their interpretation, because when I first read the bill, I didn't know if it really accomplished what our goal was, myself and Mr. Fox. So the proposal before you is to allow major party members to be able to, in a primary, to cast a ballot, and basically the sample ballot you have is one for governor of Oregon. We've used three named candidates, John Doe, Jane Doe, and Billy Bob. If you selected one of those individuals, of course, that's how the traditional process would work. If you wanted to write in someone's name for the Democratic Party nomination, that would be the line that's directly underneath that. And if you're familiar with the ballots that are used in elections, that already is provided for, no matter what level that is. What we're recommending and suggesting is that there be a second write-in line, and that would be a write-in for what could be considered a third-party candidate or other, whatever the correct terminology would be. What the way this would work is if Mr. Fox went to the ballot to cast his ballot for governor in this particular race, if he did not want to actually support any of the named Democrats or list another person as the nominee for the Democratic Party, he would have the right to basically check the other write-in line, write in the individual, and I will use the example that maybe was most recent in our past. When Senator Westland was contemplating running for governor, and he was contemplating running outside of the two major parties, if Mr. Fox wanted to support that name in the May primary, he would write in Ben Westland in that write-in for a third-party candidate. Now, under Oregon law, the individuals who are running as third-party or minor-party candidates, they are not declared until August. So there's a little disjunction here. The way this would work is that basically what Mr. Fox would be doing by taking and exercising that right of putting Ben Westland's name on the write-in for third-party candidate, he would basically be signing the signature that Senator Westland could have been floating around to qualify for the ballot as a independent candidate. And the way this would count is that at the time that Ben Westland or whoever is in that position was submitting their signatures for qualification for the ballot, then at that point the clerks in each of the counties would report any signature or any names that were any ballots that were cast for him. So it would be another way of applying a signature to the initiative for an individual and still retain the right to vote on other Democratic issues. Of course, this could apply to a Republican the same. If they wanted to be able to vote in their primary, they would be able to vote for in any other race that's on their ballot and any other issues that they have that would be limited to Republican input. And then they would still have the ability to write in. That's the framework. I'm going to ask Mr. Fox to give his comments at this time, and then if there's questions, we'd love to answer those or attempt to answer them.
Senator Prezanski, just before we turn it over to Mr. Fox, I just wanted to announce, I see Sue Gravy here in the committee, and 444, it has been taken off the agenda, and I look forward to working this issue during the interim. So let's get her out of here. So, no offense.
She could stay.
No offense. She can stay if she wants to, but. Go be productive. Okay, Mr. Fox.
Yes, thank you for your time. During the primary election. Oh, excuse me. My name is Greg Fox. I live in Cottage Grove, Oregon, Lane County. Now, during the primary election, there are many issues on the ballot, such as public schools, public safety, school budgets, tax measures, and a wide array of important items which we as voters need to address. In addition to these items, there are candidates from our individual party who are competing to represent the party in the general election. Some of these candidates are people we feel will represent us well, but there are times when you simply cannot support any of the candidates of your party for a particular office on a primary ballot. You should be able to look outside of your party. If you see a person whom you feel represents your interest and you wish to support them by a signature to help place them on the ballot in the general election as an independent, you should have that option. As it is now, the only way to accomplish this is by not voting in the primary and signing their petition. The voter then loses out on being heard on all other important issues and offices that are on the primary ballot. This is where I found myself in the last primary election. This is not right. Senate Bill 685 addresses this problem and should be moved forward in the legislative process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Questions? Senator Farrielly.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I was under the impression that people could do write-ins currently and without regard to party affiliation or any other consideration.
They can't, Madam Chair, Senator Farrielly. You can do the write-in, but the thing is when you write in under the traditional ballot now, you're nominating that individual for the Democratic or the Republican nomination. What Mr. Fox is wanting to be able to do is go outside of that bound, still retain his position as a Democrat, and be able to vote on other issues that were on the primary ballot. Once you vote in the primary ballot, it's been interpreted that they are not able to then support somebody in an independent attempt to get onto the ballot in the general election. So one of the things I think that's really important, we hear and we see how many independents or individuals that have been major party members are leaving and going to become independents. One of the ways I think for the major parties to retain their membership is to allow for some flexibility, and instead of having their members say, well, I can no longer stay a Democrat or a Republican because I really want to be able to have more flexibility. This would give some flexibility. Now, I do want to mention that what we are proposing is not to do this for each and every race that's on the ballot, but for the statewide partisan races, the ones that seem to be much higher profile, where I, from my discussions with Mr. Fox, and a few others that I've spoken with would want to exercise that right as compared to, let's say, in a more narrow, smaller office type of position where you would probably be more likely to support a write-in, as you're saying, Senator Farrielly, for someone to replace those that are named on the ballot for the party nomination.
Further question, Madam Chair?
Senator Perlin.
Would this affect the elector status of the person who uses the line that writes in for a third-party candidate? In other words, today, Madam Chairman, if I understand this correctly, if you vote in the Democratic primary, you cannot later be an elector as an independent signator on a nominating petition. So by writing in a third party's candidate's name, do you become an elector in a third party election?
Thank you for the question, Madam Chair, Senator Farioli. That's not the intent of Mr. Fox or myself. We believe that this would be, when written appropriately into the legislation, would allow for major party members to be able to go outside of that process for that particular race that they exercise, that just to allow them that flexibility without losing their identification and their position as a major party member.
Senator Farioli.
Madam Chair, I'm very confused about this. But my understanding is if I signed a petition for an independent party candidate prior to the primary, I could not vote in that primary since I'd already become an elector. So my question remains is if I signed this writing, am I not making myself an elector in an independent primary election and affecting my status as a major party member?
I understand. I think Mr. Fox wanted to respond, and I'll follow up.
Very much so. Before the actual primary election, I called the election office to ask them, because I had heard that if you signed a petition to like in this case it was Mr. Westland, and I was investigating whether I wished to do that or not, and I had heard that you could not sign a petition and vote because your petition would be then negated. So my question to the elections office was, what if I don't want to bother voting for the governor, the people that were put forward by my party to be governor? I did not feel that they were representing my interest, and I wanted to look elsewhere. And they said that if I voted in the primary on any race, whether it was for the governor or not, if I did not write it in, did not vote for a governor, I have not voted twice for the same office. And I think that's what we need to keep focused on here, is that I wish to vote once for every office. I don't wish to vote for, you know, who the Republican Party is putting up and then turn around and vote for an independent to put them on the same ballot face to face. That's not the intent of this. I think it's wrong that I had to make a choice between signing a petition and losing all of the other things that I could vote on that were in that primary.
Madam Chair, Senator Farrell. So really what we're attempting to do is give this individual who wants to exercise those rights in the primary for any other race that option. And clearly what the intent and what we would expect that the law would be, if you use this process, you would not lose your major party affiliation. And that's why, because it's actually being done at the time that you're voting in the primary. It's just a means to allow those individuals who are just disenfranchised by the major party nominees and not wanting to write in another individual for the party's nominee, but go outside and allow them to exercise that right for an independent, but still retain their major party affiliation.
Senator Prezansky, Mr. Fox, I think what I'm struggling with is the ballots only go to those voters in the primary, correct? The Democrats and the Republicans, right? So how do you not allow then members of non-affiliate parties to have that same balloting process? I mean, how do we create a level playing field, so to speak?
Okay, my question is, what happens with all of the propositions that were on the ballot? Independents vote on those. They just simply do
don't
not
get the rest of the ballot. Well, we've got the county clerks here. Let's bring them up and see if they can help us.
Before this panel leaves, Madam Chair, one follow-up.
Senator Farioli.
On both sides of the political aisle, we have many people who have dual nominations. That is to say, they're nominated by both of the political parties. And the county elections officers are required, or I believe they're required, to keep track of all these nominations, because that's how the Secretary of State determines that there have been sufficient write-in numbers to create a nomination. But under this scenario, do folks who write in a name for the third party's candidate become petitioners on that nomination petition as well?
Madam Chair, Senator Farioli, I would, if I understand the question, I believe that is the intent here, in the sense that by, let's say, Mr. Fox writing in Ben Westline's name here, that signature would count as a signature toward Ben Westland ballot or initiative to qualify for the general election. Mm-hmm. And that way he's able to actually exercise that right on the non-major party and still participate as a Democrat or as a Republican. And it's kind of trying to get outside the box of where we're now seeing people say, well, we should have open election, open primaries. We should do away with the two-party system. There's many ways that maybe you can get here. This is just another way, and I
okay.
would say...
And I guess, Senator Pruszynski, I guess Senator Courtney had an amendment that would allow the parties to... statutorily changes, so the parties would allow folks who are independents to vote in the primary. That's sort of the opposite side of the issue. So anyway, unfortunately, this committee did not hear the open primary bill. That bill went to Senator Monroe's committee. So why don't we bring up Ms. Newingham, and maybe she can help us out a little bit.
And Madam Chair, the reason for that question is that I see a burden that may fall upon the elections officials. In years past, when I've called and asked about the write-ins, besides the usual Daffy Duck and Mickey Mouse and some of the others, it's quite burdensome for the county elections officials to account for the write-ins from every ballot. They have to literally hand count them and tabulate them. There's no mechanism to do that mechanically. And this, I think, approaches an unfunded mandate. It's going to be significantly burdensome to the county.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Ms. Newingham, why don't you make us smart on this issue, please?
Okay. Annette Newingham, I'm here on behalf of the Association of County Clerks, and I'm Lane County's election official. I can kind of go through my testimony, which kind of talks about a couple of the issues, the concerns that county clerks have. Section 1, which goes through lines 24 through 30, this section allows a person that is affiliated with a major party to nominate a minor party candidate on the same ballot. This appears to require, and was confirmed by Senator Pruszynski, that an extra write-in line for each partisan contest on the ballot. Not only would this likely increase the cost due to longer ballots, but it would impact the counting of ballots. Current counting systems... what it does is that for every, like if you have vote for one, it will put one write in line so that so someone can do a write in lieu of voting for the candidate that is on the ballot, candidate or whichever choice they have. This would actually create a need for an uneven amount and an extra write in line, and our systems currently cannot do that, so they'd have to be reprogrammed by vendors. Which also would require that then it would have to be recertified at the federal level, retesters recertified, and also at the state level before we could actually use that equipment, which then, in the meantime, we would have to hand count those ballots. So that's beyond the write-in portion. There's also a concern that this change on the ballot would result in voter confusion. Voter education would be essential with associated costs. The Section 2, lines 14 through 20, under current law, any voter registered in a major party that casts their ballot at the primary election and signs a nominating petition for a minor party candidate, the signature will not count towards the required number of signatures. This change would require a tally of write-in votes cast for each candidate who is not a member of a major party that filed a certificate of nomination by the date of the primary election. Currently, election officials do not tally write-ins unless they exceed the candidate total for a particular race or if no candidate has filed. To provide the required write-in tallies, election officials would need to sort through all ballots to isolate the specific ballots with those write-ins and hire election boards to hand tally those results with related budgetary costs. This section, also the way it's currently written, would only apply to individual electors since minor party candidate filings cannot be filed until after the primary election.
So
we talked about that the intent and how it's written may not be quite the same. Also in Section 3, which is, it's just the language, this section pertains to precincts using voting machines, which suggests this language pertains to poll elections. And since Oregon conducts its elections by mail, it seems to not apply at all. We really, the Association of County Clerks, urge your careful consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Pozanski, do you want to make any sort of...
We understand. I mean, as Senator Farioli said, I mean, they are talking about doing business differently. Yeah, there would be a cost. But the part, I guess the point is, if we're trying to open up the process to allow individuals to participate in a major party and stay and maintain their affiliation, this is one way we believe it can be done. Just like any type of change, there could be and more than likely would be a cost. And it may be something that we as a state would have to take on, but I guess there's many ways of looking at this. We could also do away with the major parties. I mean, you could actually just go to non-affiliations and just basically have people out there and everything be nonpartisan. Maybe that's another means of doing it. But the thought here was, what is it that we can do to allow those individuals who are members of the major parties to be able to go beyond what the current rules allow them to do? Let me just give one other perspective, and I think this would be something that we may actually want to look at as well. I'm not sure what the history is, but why is it that we have the minor parties being elected at a different time from the major parties? Why is it not until August that they go through that process? Maybe one of the things that we could do is venture into having all of those different individuals who are seeking whatever office they're seeking in a partisan race to be on the same time schedule and allowing for the nominations to occur, in this case, as we currently have it in May. That in itself may actually make it easier for the process that we're talking about to be carried forward.
And Senator Pozanski, I totally hear you about wanting folks who are members of the major parties to be able to participate and nominate candidates for other parties. I hear what you're saying there. I think what concerns me is the impact of this giving sort of an unlevel playing field for minor folks, independents, for example, getting someone on the ballot have to collect signatures. And why would we not give them the opportunity to do write-in? I mean, I think there's some tricky things that before we would move forward that we would need to resolve. So, no, I appreciate you guys bringing this to us. I think it's very interesting. And maybe we need to have a conversation with Senator Monroe about kind of what he's going to move forward with. Mr. Fox, did you want to say something before? Okay.
No, we've addressed it.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate you bringing this forward. Interesting issue.
I appreciate the committee's time for hearing myself and my constituent, Mr. Fox, on the issue. And if you all are interested in looking at ways of maybe trying to carry this forward, I know Mr. Fox and myself would be willing to work with the committee.
And Ms. Newingham, should we have a work group, we'll make sure you get a call.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 685? Not hearing any or seeing any volunteers. We're going to close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on both Senate Bill 494 and Senate Bill 495. Ms. Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 494 and 495 come to you from the Law Commission. And you'll remember we had an evening meeting in with the House Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee to hear all of their bills. And now they're coming back to you specifically with 494, which does have the -1 amendment from Senator Farioli. And 495 has the -1 amendment from the Law Commission.
Mr. Attorney General, are you wishing to testify? No, you're just... Okay, all right. Let's bring up Wendy Johnson, Jerry Watson, and Ron Burson. And same thing on 495, and then Norman Turrell will bring you up as soon as we're done with this panel. So, good afternoon. Welcome back. Good to see all of you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I think I just wanted to put this into context, today's hearing, and just thank you for scheduling both Senate Bill 494 and 495. As your committee staff, Marjorie Taylor, has explained, we have a package of Law Commission bills in the area of ethics this session, 10 bills, 5 were filed in the House, 5 were filed in the Senate. These are the first two bills this committee has heard. The reason they're separate today is you've heard much on the area of ethics already in this committee with your Senate Bill 10. The items up for discussion in the bills today are areas that were not discussed at all in Senate Bill 10. Senate Bill 494 regards conflicts of interest, and Senate Bill 495 regards nepotism. Our special counsel, Jerry Watson, focused on this area of law in the interim, and so he will be explaining the conflict of interest bill first. And as committee staff and yourself, Madam Chair, recognize, the Attorney General is here as well. He served as chair of the work group and as the commissioner of the Law Commission, and is here to assist as necessary, along with Phil Schradl, special counsel to the Attorney General. But I'd like to just have Jerry Watson explain the details of the conflicts bill, Senate Bill 494, first.
Thank you.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Jerry Watson, special counsel to the Oregon Law Commission. This is not a terribly long bill, but it gets a little complicated. I know you're used to looking at complicated bills, but let's try to go through it. I want to kind of deal with three packages of things that are in the bill. You have a one-page handout, I believe, on this. Maybe I didn't get it up here. Let's bring it up. It's not in there. The first thing to point out is that the overarching principle of governmental ethics in a democratic society is the fiduciary concept of public service as a public trust. And conflicts of interest, which are very common in the public sector, can interfere with that trust relationship. So we kind of start from that perspective. SB 494 makes some changes to conflict laws that are applicable to public officials in Oregon, and it does so primarily concerning what public officials must do or must not do when the official has either an actual or potential conflict of interest. There are two basic ways of dealing with conflicts of interest. One is to require disclosure. The other is to either restrict or prohibit a public official from taking action or making a decision in situations involving conflict. Existing Oregon law and SB 494, although they differ, employ both of these devices to a degree. Existing Oregon law requires public officials to disclose all actual and potential conflicts and provides some sanctions for failure to do so. Senate Bill 494 generally preserves the existing obligation to disclose, but makes some important changes to the actions that public officials, most notably legislators, must take or are prohibited from taking subsequent disclosure when they're faced with an actual conflict of interest. The purpose behind those changes are to enhance the uniformity of the treatment of public officials and generally to make the requirements of the conflicts legislation more readily understandable. So at this point, I'd like to turn to the three clusters of things that you will find in this bill. The first is there are a number of provisions that are amended or added, mostly amended, to simply clarify existing law. This is done in large part through reorganizing statutory provisions and providing greater consistency in the use of terminology, referring to particular kinds of public officials. For example, the term On occasion, the term other appointed official is used in the existing statute. That's a very confusing term for the layperson, if you will, who tends to think of an appointed official as someone who is perhaps on a board or commission having some relatively significant stature associated with it, not realizing that the way in which it's used, it encompasses everyone that isn't basically referred to elsewhere in the statute, including volunteers. So some of that is cleaned up. These In this package of items that are primarily relatively technical, I would point out, and these are all found on the one-page summary that I had for you, that the first thing that happens is it continues the existing requirement that all public officials have to disclose potential and actual interests. That doesn't change. Secondly, it continues and clarifies the provisions that indicate that most all public officials are disqualified from participating in any fashion in any situation where there is an actual or potential conflict. Now, that's most public officials, and practically that means employees, it means volunteers, and so forth. There are exemptions, and the exemptions cover judges, members of the Legislative Assembly, other elected public officials, and members of boards or commissions. And we've tightened up the use of those terms throughout. The third change that's part of these clarifying provisions, if you will, continues and clarifies provisions that allow members of the Legislative Assembly, other elected public officials except judges, and appointed members of boards and commissions, those three categories, if you will, to participate freely in situations involving potential conflict after they disclose. Come back to actual conflicts in a moment. And there is a continuation of a provision that elected public officials other than the legislators and appointed members of boards and commissions may not participate in any discussion, debate, or vote on a matter that, where they have an actual conflict. So the only ones that can are legislators. Okay. There's a clarification, a minor one, perhaps, that attempts to spell out an exception that was already in existing law dealing with necessity for local governmental officials on city councils and so forth, that tightens up what it means for a person's vote to be necessary, and we've given some structure to that. Okay, that's the first package of items that are in this bill.
Professor Watson, before you move on to the second package, maybe what I will do is take questions at this point, if
sure.
That's okay.
Sure.
Questions? Anyone?
Madam Chair, I have some questions about the conflict of interest, the whole concept.
Okay. So let's take your questions. Anybody else at the end? Is that okay, Senator Ferry?
Sure.
Let me ask this question, Professor Watson, and that's my understanding is that Section 1 allows the Legislative Assembly to participate in floor votes on matters involving actual conflict, but otherwise you prohibit participation in committee, floor discussion, and caucus meetings. And I guess I'm sort of troubled by that because I see our vote as being the most important thing that we have here is our ability to actually cast a vote. And so it seems to me that it's sort of backwards. So I'll throw that out there, and that's just my sense of it. I think the other question I would have is, how do you see this being policed? So without any of the caucuses having any press in their caucus meetings.
Sure. That's an issue we have not addressed, but that's... Let me get back to that in a moment. Really, I think you're going directly to the second package because
right.
I was holding out the whole issue of what happens to members of the Legislative Assembly. In other words, I was trying to tell you first about those changes which, for the most part, although they generated a reasonable amount of discussion and some vigorous discussion, went through our process with a high degree of consensus, and we don't feel are really controversial. But one area in which there is change is with regard to what members of the legislature would be allowed to do once a an actual conflict exists. And this is really the only, except for repackaging and rearranging things and clarifying terminology, the only real change that happens in this area. One of the goals that we started with was a goal of trying to treat all public officials as much alike as possible, and to on the belief that that was a good matter of policy, but that it also allowed an enhanced clarity of the rules, because if you begin to look at rules that break down into very large numbers of categories, they get difficult to understand. At the same time, trying to recognize that, that you can't have a one-size-fits-all, mm-hmm. exactly. Okay, and so the bill on this part and dealing with this issue is a kind of a compromise from various positions, but it's definitely moving in the direction and has the intent of moving in the direction of treating legislators more like other public officials with regard to actual conflicts, okay. And specifically more like other elected public officials with regard to those conflicts. And the general rule under the old rule, or the existing rule, if you will, and in the proposal would say that other elected public officials have to announce the conflict, the actual conflict, and then they must refrain from doing anything, really, unless the very narrow exception of necessity applies.
Professor Watson, just one other thing. Is that kind of what's happening across the country? I mean, one of the distinctions that we make between legislators and other elected officials, you know, depending upon the body, like obviously the mayor of Adel and the mayor of, I don't know about Ontario, some of the other smaller communities are probably do have other jobs. Their citizen mayor, so to speak, as opposed to, for example, Tom Potter, who clearly has got his hands full with running with the city council, the city of Portland. So I guess one of the distinctions is that a legislature has been a citizen legislature, and we have other jobs in order, most of us, in order to make a living. I guess my question for you is, what's happening across the country? Is the reforms going this direction where legislators are being treated like other electeds for conflict of interest purposes, or did the commission not look at that issue at all?
I don't believe we looked at that issue specifically. Okay. In the background research that I did, my impression would be that that there's a considerable amount of diversity between states. If I were to try to apply a broad brush characterization to the movement of public ethics laws, it would be towards greater restrictions for any number of reasons, including the fact that those restrictions may make perfectly good sense, and because of the public perception kinds of issues that might drive on occasion public bodies to adopt rules for that kind of benefit as well. The states actually have a variety of definitions of what constitutes a conflict. This may be one way to address it. They define it in a large variety of ways. For the most part, and Oregon is one of those, the kinds of conflicts that are covered by our conflicts laws are financial or pecuniary conflicts, but there are broader definitions in some places. Oregon, like probably the largest number of states, draws a distinction between actual and potential conflicts. We haven't always done that. There was a period in the 80s when we did not draw that distinction. Most all states that have anything in their laws on this matter require disclosure. Whether one can vote or not differs from state to state, and I can't give you a precise trend line on that. If I could get back to the
I'll be quiet.
Package, though, I do want to point out that the biggest change here, as you properly noted, Senator Brown, has to do with restricting the kinds of actions that legislators can undertake, and to expand the scope of that from the rather minimal present requirements to disclose, and really the disclosure under the statute only has to take place prior to the vote. Our proposal would call for that to happen earlier, but partly because there are more things that are covered. We're covering committee meetings and the like. I think that if you're looking for why this is reasonable, I'd like to offer four thoughts. The first is that it gets back to this enhancing uniformity of laws. It's somewhat difficult. I think you can make some arguments about the level at which a legislature operates and the need to make decisions and be on record. But it's hard to find a precise rationale why allowing legislators to vote in actual conflicts exists, but restrictions on everyone else is permissible. Secondly, as a practical matter, there are very, very few actual conflicts that you as legislators would ever face. By the definition of an actual conflict, there is an exception in the existing statute that provides for what's known as the class exception. And if you are part of a class, then the rule doesn't apply. That's going to take out most things because you generally deal with broad pieces of legislation that affect everybody, or at least affect a number of people. For example, let me just kind of make it concrete. If the Legislative Assembly were to have a bill calling for the purchase of a specific piece of property belonging to a legislator, for example, Senator Ferrioli, don't know why I think that. That legislator would probably have an actual conflict. On the other hand, a bill that would decrease or increase taxes on the property that would affect the zoning of that property, as long as other properties similarly situated were affected alike, or affect the property in many, many other ways that could affect the financial interest of any one of you, would not invoke the requirement to either, I think generally, would not invoke the requirement to disclose or the requirement to refrain from acting. So it's really only a narrow subset, and I would assume that you are far less likely to have those conflicts than local public officials are to have those conflicts. One argument that could be made has to do with your rules, the rules of the House and the Senate, which do not, as they presently are structured, conform really at all to what we are proposing in this particular rule. They don't, I think, conform quite, and this is just a more or less an off-the-cuff mark, conform precisely to what the existing statute is, but that's perhaps another issue. That's not really so much an argument against the statutory proposal as it is an argument to amend your rules to be consistent with that proposal. And in addition to having this statutory proposal, the Law Commission has advanced in its report to you that came out at the end of January a series of non-statutory recommendations. The first one to the legislature is to amend your rules in this regard. Fourth, there is a sense in which what we're dealing with here is a constitutional question. I think it really is not. It has some constitutional aspects, but the proposal, whether it is wise policy or not, I believe is constitutionally sound. The issues there revolve around the speech and debate clause in the Oregon Constitution, and the clause, that's section for our Article 4, Section 9, and Article 4, Section 11, which tells that you have the authority to make your own rules. You may recall that in the past there were issues that arose about the authority of GSPC to adjudicate matters involving legislators. And the Attorney General's Office issued an opinion in 1999 indicating that that authority would not exist. Subsequently, ORS 244-260 was amended, and the amendment specifically provides that the GSPC is obligated to look at any matter involving a legislator, determine if it involves the constitutional protections accorded to the legislature, and if so, to drop the matter. Nothing in the proposed legislation gives the GSPC or any other administrative agency authority to adjudicate matters involving legislative free speech. OS 244-260 is simply not affected by this bill, and its continued existence under the Law Commission proposal eliminates, I think, the possible conflict between the role of the GSPC and the constitutional provisions for Section 9. That's really what I had to say on that issue. There are some other parts of this, but if you want to stop at this point and
why don't you go on through? I think Senator Farrelly's questions are sort of on the bigger picture.
Okay. All right. There are the third package of things, if you will, are other changes that aren't really a neat package. So I'm just going to go over them. We felt they were all reasonable, the work group and the commission did. They are generally fairly narrow in focus, but they are there, and you may wonder what they are if you haven't integrated the thinking all the way through. Perhaps the most important, I think clearly the most important, is a decision in the Law Commission bills and in this bill in particular to expand the definition of relative and member of the household. Those definitions are found in ORS 244.020, and the definition of relative is expanded to include a number of other relationships that are family or family-like that previously were not covered. Among those, domestic partners and a somewhat broader group of actual relatives. And you can look at the statutory provision in Section 2, sub 16, for that. Member of the household, as it presently exists in law, is an interesting one. It's a relative. It's defined as a relative who lives with you. So if common sense tells you the member of the household might be somebody who's living with you but not a relative, the statute kind of feeds back in on the definition of relative. So that definition has been expanded to basically include anybody who resides in the same household. Now, those are important because what they do is they play into the definitions of the kinds of conflicts that create problems for all public officials, so that if there is an interest that you are dealing with that involves one of those relatives or members of the household that previously were not part of the definition, you would now have that would be a conflict issue at this point. So that's an expansion. It seems to be a logical and one that has a high degree of consensus, I think, in our work group on those terms. The next is a provision that's found in Section 1.6 that modifies an existing exception to conflicts of interest that for membership on a nonprofit, 501c3 nonprofit. And we took that out. You'll find a provision that's out. I'll be happy to go through the line by lines on some of these later on if you're interested. But it comes out at one point and comes back in a limited fashion. It comes back in by a person being able to disclose it. This is legislators and others required to disclose it, but allowed to act on it irrespective of the disclosure. So it provides more information to the public but doesn't influence the action or prevent the actions of any public official by making that change. Another provision provides that interest in a mutual fund will not create a conflict of interest for each stock that's held in the fund. I don't know how you deal with your individual stock funds, but I know what their name is, but I don't know what stocks are necessarily held by them. And this just seemed to be a rather small uncertainty in the existing law that people wanted to pin down. There is a provision largely coming at the request of local government people that allows a public official to make salary recommendations for the public official's own salary or the salary of a relative or household member, something that would clearly be a conflict. If that recommendation, making that recommendation, is part of the official's duties or responsibilities. And there are, particularly in our smaller communities, situations where you have an obligation to make that kind of a recommendation. There really is no one else to do it, and there's a difficulty. So that's the rather narrow exception that was put in. So there are three packages of things. The broad, let's say, clarifying provisions. The major provision dealing with how to handle actual conflicts of interest for members of the Legislative Assembly. And thirdly, a bundle of other kind of other factors, usually fairly focused, that that were also dealt with in this bill. And I'd be happy to go over the different sections, if you wish. There are only seven of them, really. Several of those sections have only or largely LC form and style or conforming changes in them. The key parts of this bill are Section 1, which makes a number of changes, probably the largest number of changes. It includes most of what I talked about in that first package of items and the change with regard to members of the legislature. Section 2 modifies some definitions, modifies the definition of business and business with which the public is associated. That's really necessary because of the change in the nonprofit corporation provision, and so it's a kind of a conforming change. And also, this is where you'll find the amendment that allows ownership of individual stocks in a mutual fund not to constitute a conflict, and for the changes in the definition of a relative and member of the household. Section 3 has only one, it has a number of changes in it, but they are all LC conforming style changes with one exception, and that is this is where the provision allowing the recommendation of salary, your own salary, salary of a relative occurs. Section 4 is a cleanup provision that really conforms the definition of business and business for which the public is associated with the other provision in Section 2. Section 5 contains LC changes to another chapter that continue to provide here the use of a narrow definition of relative member of the household, the definition that was used there. And the reason this was needed to be changed is it was keyed at that point to Chapter 244. This more or less disconnects it from 244, leaves it in place. That seemed to be a policy issue that the work group was not wanting to try to address at this point. Section 6 is listed only as a repeal, and you may wonder what that is all about. Part of the inconsistency and complexity of existing law stems from the large number of categories of people that are treated differently, one of which happens to be local planning commissioners. And there was a special process that is set out in that chapter to deal with them. We decided for consistency there was no need for local planning commissioners. There was no objection on the part of local government officials for this. And so they are treated as all other members of appointed boards and commissions are. And that just simply simplifies the law and creates greater uniformity. And the last section, section 7 of the bill contains the effective date provisions. And that's my remarks.
Questions, Senator Farioli?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You touched on this in your testimony, Doctor, but the restraint of free speech, in with particularly within a caucus meeting, seems to be inconsistent with Oregon's rather vigorous free speech constitutional protections. So how, in fact, would this restraint of discussion, you can't even mention it, within a caucus meeting, which isn't a legislative function, by the way, not be a restraint of free speech?
You're talking in terms of free speech, the provisions of Article 4, Section 9?
Yeah, what I'm referring to specifically is that that a member of the Legislative Assembly...
I'm sorry, I meant constitutional provision, Article 4.
Yes, section. Exactly right. Yeah. And I guess I'm referring to the section that begins on line 21, page 1.
Line 21.
Except as provided in the subsection of this section, when met with an actual conflict of interest, a member of the Legislative Assembly shall not announce publicly pursuant to the rules right. relevant, blah, 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 nor participate in discussion or debate, even in the... even in legislative caucus meetings. That's line 1, page 2.
Correct.
Now tell me that. Tell me how that squares with a vigorous protection for free speech in the Constitution.
Well, the provisions of Article 4, Section 9 have a lot to do with who can regulate the speech and prevents anybody from calling into question the speech in another forum other than the chamber. The opinion of the Attorney General in 1999 emphasizes that in reaching its decision that, in fact, the USPC would not have that authority. It doesn't specifically provide for free speech, I think, so much as it speaks in the negative to nobody being able to restrain that, not nobody being able to take it into account or brought into court because of something that's said in the legislative arena. And in fact, the legislative arena is defined at least because we don't have a court opinion on it, but we have the Attorney General's opinion, is defined fairly broadly, and it certainly is not limited to floor session, for example. May not even be limited to things that take place entirely within the confines of a legislative building. Yeah. And I think that... Wendy would like.
Yes, ma'am. Please drop in anytime.
Vice Chair Farioli, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson again for the record. I think there are two speech issues in Oregon constitutional letters, Article 4, Section 9, which is what Professor Watson has been talking about, the speech and debate clause that applies to the Assembly. And then there's Article 1, Section 8, which is the general free speech provision. We do have, as you've commented, Senator Farioli, we do have broad free speech laws in Oregon, but they're not... There are some limits on that speech. You're not allowed to commit slander or libel. Or we do have conflict of interest rules that apply to other public officials. We do have bribery laws. I mean, there are certain things you're just not allowed to do that would be speech. And we believe that this would fall under that. When you have an actual conflict, restricting that speech would be permitted under Article 1, Section 8. And we also believe it would work under Article 4, Section 9, the speech and debate clause, as Professor Watson has explained.
We disagree.
I think that's
let me just give you, at least in following along that line of questioning, there's only one act in the legislative arena, and everything other than that is pre-decisional, and the act is taking a vote. We've had that
explained ad nauseum in legal opinions. And so the action taken by a legislator is to make the vote. The question here is that whether or not a legislator has a duty to act. We are elected to come and represent constituents, and in that, I think, is implicit the duty to act, and the definition of a legislator's act is a vote. In the issues of conflict of interest or apparent conflict of interest or perceived conflict of interest, our duty is to disclose. And in that disclosure, what we're doing is we're putting our colleagues on notice that there is a perceived or a potential or an actual conflict. And I think, colleagues, that a much better way to approach this whole issue of full disclosure, while at the same time discharging the duties of the legislator, which are to act, can much better be found in the language that's been developed by the Oregon Investment Board. And that's a discussion I've had with members of the panel in the past and language I brought here today. And that is that in the case where a member of the House or Senate has a perceived or actual conflict of interest, that within a matter of days of them being made aware of that potential conflict or actual conflict of interest attaching to an issue being put under consideration of the legislature, that they will in writing notify the Secretary of the Senate or the Secretary of the House of Representatives, so that it is a matter of record that they have notified on the conflict of interest. That is precisely what this Oregon Investment Board has done to deal with the conflict of interest. And I think it gets precisely at the issue of full disclosure. It does not provide what I would consider to be an unconscionable setting aside of the legislator's duty, and I which is to vote. And I can also see that conflicted members that may have a pecuniary interest in an issue may be the best informed member in the legislature about what the issue is. And to restrain that person from being able to discuss this issue in committee after having notified the committee chair and the members of their conflict is irrational. And to prevent that person from discussing the issue in a caucus meeting, which is, it may be a function ancillary to the, or ancillary to the legislative function, but it is not a function of record. It is pre-decisional. There is no way that I can determine that you would have the ability to, even in statute, preclude a caucus from having any discussion on any matter at any time whatsoever. So I guess what I'm saying to you is that the premise that you're taking in this bill, I think, misses the solution to the problem, which is full disclosure of conflict of interest, but a duty to discharge your legislative duty, which is to vote. We don't have a maybe button.
Senator Farrielli, I'm going to bring the Attorney General up. Would you like to respond, Mr. Attorney General? Mr. Burson, I know you're just dying to talk, but we're going to...
I don't know. I don't perceive that he's just dying to do anything.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Farrielli, yeah. Hardy Myers, Attorney General. First of all, on the constitutional issue, Senator Farrielli, I would pretty confidently assert that the restriction on the use of speech for what is basically self-dealing would fall within the types of expression that can be regulated consistently with Article 1, Section 8. I understand we disagree, but I would like to add my voice to the others that I think that's a perfectly defensible position, and to the extent it's a constitutional issue, it exists right now all across government because the legislature has prohibited the very kinds of actions we're talking about here with respect to all other elected officials. And so I really think, with respect, Senator Farrielli, members, that the question the Legislative Assembly has got to ask is whether or not there is really a justification for the Assembly treating itself differently from other public elected officials when there is an actual conflict of interest. And the way actual conflict of interest is described, and when you bear in mind the exceptions, you are talking virtually about a situation where that member very specifically, individually, and virtually alone is pecuniarily benefited by the action that's before the assembly, the potential action. It's that focused. And in that circumstance, the assembly has said other public officials may not use their office to advance a matter that has that effect.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly, just are you done, Mr. Attorney General? I think you actually hit at the heart of the matter. I think the problem, Mr. Attorney General, is the fact that we as a legislature don't have a good understanding about actual and potential conflict of interest, and most members declare a conflict when they are a member of a class, just to be safe rather than be sorry. In fact, I was even exploring whether I should be doing that, for example, on the indigent defense budget, simply because I worked for a firm last year that obviously received contract dollars from the indigent defense fund. So anyway, I think the problem is in our lack of understanding of when do we have an actual conflict and when is there a potential conflict. And we're declaring potential in a pretty broad matter of circumstances. So I think you really hit on the heart of the matter. Senator Farrelly.
I think we should explore that, Madam Chair. Let me give an example that is personal and then ask a question of the good professor. I am a vested member in PERS by virtue of having worked for the state of Oregon in my youth well into the last century. It was in about 80, in the 80s, put it that way. But I was vested in PERS. In the last legislative cycle, we all were asked to vote on the question of whether or not we would reduce the obligation of PERS by about $6 billion. And that issue would have had a negative pecuniary interest personally to me. Not only as a member of a class, but not all PERS members were affected equally. Not all are vested in Tier 1, which I am. And so I chose to make the vote which would affect me personally negatively. I spoke in favor of the issue. I worked in favor of the reform because the $6 billion that we needed to remove as an obligation was decimating jurisdictions all across the state of Oregon. And it hurt me personally. It hurt my wife personally. Now, under this provision, you can argue that I'm a member of a class. You can also argue that I'm an individual affected more than other members of the class and therefore would not be allowed under this provision to discuss the issue in caucus, to deliberate in the issue in front of a committee, or to vote yes to do the PERS reform on the floor. Now, please explain how you square that.
Either one of you can answer. This is a very interesting conversation.
I'll be happy to try. I don't think you can resolve it fully without some discussion. The existing rule has some of the same language in it already, but because if you look on page 5 of the rule, you'll find that the definition of this class, or what would constitute a class, is subject to rulemaking by GSPC. And it says the commission may by rule limit the minimum size of or otherwise establish criteria for or identify the smaller classes that qualify under this exception. So there is a kind of procedure to address it, but if you're asking if you can create a definition that removes all ambiguity, I think that would be very difficult.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
Madam Chair, I guess I regret the assumption that every time there's a pecuniary interest, the legislator will choose to benefit themselves, and that's implicit in this prohibition. I know that not to be true.
If that's the case, if I could go back to your earlier comments, Senator Farrelly, if the only action, well, couple of things. If the only action being taken by a member of the Legislative Assembly is the final vote, then the logic of being concerned about restrictions on actions other than the final vote is somewhat less compelling. The fact of the matter is that if there's a negative inference here, it's a negative inference that the members of the legislature at some point in time in the past have made with regard to all other public officials who are subject to the same criteria. We may be starting at a different point, but I would reemphasize what the Attorney General had to say. If we start, as we tried to do in the work group process, by saying, let's try to develop a system that's logical, that's consistent, that's understandable, that's clear, fair, and all of those things, admitting that there's ambiguity in those terms, we tended to start by assuming let's take a fairly specific, broad position on a given issue with regard to conflicts, how should not, for example. And then say, if we need to back off of that, what's the rationale that really justifies this distinction, this treating this group of people differently than that group of people, and so on. And in many cases, we found that didn't exist. The rationale for treating planning commission members, which seemed to be very narrow, for why. And all I can tell you is that in the deliberations of the work group, as we as staff watched and observed that, or deliberations of the law commission, there did not seem to be a compelling reason why most of this should be treated differently. Now, the last observation is the final point. If, in fact, the key issue is the vote is still preserved. Everything else is what gets regulated.
So, Mr. Sure, Attorney General.
If I could just underscore one other point, and then I'm going to probably go back to my seat. I really do think that the question the Assembly has to ask itself is there really a justification for treating the Assembly different from all other public officials when there's an actual conflict of interest as defined? I think that's a really quite very small number of situations. Very small.
It is, Madam Chair.
But I really think that is the issue. And, of course, the recommendation before you from the Law Commission, respectfully, is that no, we invite you to conclude, no, there really isn't a justification for treating members of the Assembly different from other elected officials when there's an actual conflict. And the only other point I would want to underscore is that I think in making the assessment, whatever it ultimately turns out to be, it is really important for the members to keep focused on the fact that we're talking about actual conflicts.
And not potential.
And not potential. Not sliding into these much larger situations.
I've got Senator Montes Anderson here with a question.
I just want to, besides the PERS, let's cite another example. We have a physician who worked on malpractice and using workers' comp reserve fund to pay for medical malpractice for those physicians located in rural areas. It was vital that the physician who could benefit from this work on that with the groups. We would not have had good, as it wouldn't have been as easy to come out with the policy that we have to rectify what has happened in the past unless that physician was a part of the group working on it in committee and some subcommittees. So I feel that some of us who have our own expertise, even though we could benefit financially for something, are truly needed in the crafting of good policy.
Madam Chair, Senator Montes Anderson, first of all, I think that, again, as the definitions are currently drawn, I think there'd be a serious issue as to whether that would actually be an actual conflict for the particular member, assuming that a number of physicians generally would have be similarly benefited by the action that's being considered by the legislature.
Okay. We're going to be here all
Well, I guess the second and honest response to your question is that indeed, if actual conflict situations are dealt with in the way this bill proposes by the Assembly, there may be situations where a member's expertise coincides also with the self-benefit that the situation would entail, and that that's just an acceptance of this policy, as would be true with respect to other public officials, I guess represents a judgment. That's a cost we're going to accept to protect the process against situations that could be seen as form self-dealing.
Sarah Farioli has a question, and then we're going to bring Mr. Turrell up and then move to 495. Mr. Burson is here. He has signed up. We appreciate your willingness to hang out. I'm not going to bring you up. We are not going to move either of these bills today, but I would really encourage Law Commission members to continue the conversation with legislators. I know that I'm going to put this on our caucus agenda for early next week. I would encourage the Senate Republican leader to do the same. I think this is a very interesting and very complex question that we're going to have to wrestle with very quickly over the next couple of days. So, Senator Farioli.
Yeah, and Chair, it's not a question, it's just sort of a statement. There is a difference, and the difference is this. Legislators don't have an abstention. And frankly, I don't want them to. I do believe it is a matter of doing one's duty. And representing your constituency and voting on the important questions of the day, sometimes 850 times during a legislative session, is absolutely and utterly an integral part of this process. And it sends, you know, it not only demonstrates the person's commitment to the constituency, but their personal feelings on issues, their values. That voting record is probably the most important thing that legislators leave behind. And to allow an abstention, to me, violates the process. So I would suggest very strongly that the place for us here to profit is to work on disclosure and to work on transparency. But please don't ask us to walk away from the duty of a legislature, which is to vote. Now, Madam Chairman, the question, what was the offer for that property?
I don't know.
Well, I hope it's enough for me to feel really personally conflicted.
All right.
That was purely a hypothetical.
Thank you. I don't know, Wendy and Jerry, if you guys want to stay, and we'll bring up Mr. Turrell. Unless, Sam, are you the other? Okay. All right. Okay. You what? Did you?
I'm on 495.
You are? You didn't sign up. Wendy signed up on both. It's fine. No big deal. So whoever's, are you not doing 495 then?
I wasn't sure which.
Okay, he's on 494. So, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name for the record is Norman Turrell. I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon. And the League is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages the informed and active participation of citizens in government. The League has long supported a government that is responsible, responsive, and accountable to its citizens. Conflict of interest legislation is an important component of such a government. The Oregon Law Commission has proposed SB 494 with a package of other bills that is part of a project that was requested by the previous legislature. The Law Commission should be commended for their work on this and other bills. The League is generally supportive of most of the entire package of bills. SB 494 proposes important improvements to Oregon's conflict of interest statutes for all public officials and would be enforced by the Government Standards and Practices Commission. Section 1 contains most of the improvements of this bill. We note that the rest of the bill is... some of the rest of the bill is in conflict with Senate Bill 10A, that this committee debated effectively and at some length. Where there are conflicts, the League prefers the provisions of SB 10A and assumes that these conflicts will be resolved before Senate Bill 494 moves forward. In any case, the League supports improvements in conflict of interest legislation in Section 1 and urges you to pass them in some form. So often when I come to these committee hearings, I don't think that I have much to offer to what other people have said, but in this case I might. I want to point out that the staff summary used the word prohibit in relationship to actual conflicts of interest, and the word in the bill is actually refrain, that the members of the Legislative Assembly shall refrain, et cetera, when they have an actual conflict of interest. Now, I'm maybe not a grammarian or a lexicographer, but that implies to me that the legislator, if he feels compelled, could actually vote or discuss a bill in the legislature if that's their compulsion. So I want to also point out that was not afforded the ability to look at the amendment that's proposed, the Dash 1 amendment, before coming here today, and I think if that were adopted, my action committee would probably be more neutral on this bill. So,
Mr. Turrell, does that mean they would like it less?
Yes.
Okay.
I was trying to be gentle with it.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Turrell?
Only one, Madam Chair.
Sarah Ferriello.
And I appreciate more neutrality. I just learned as a declension. I didn't know that, and I bet you learn something every day in this place. Can you envision a situation where a legislator might not wish to vote on a bill, claim a conflict of interest, and essentially abstain in the process for reasons that aren't wholly honorable?
It's hard, Chair Brown and Senator Ferriello, it's hard for me to imagine that situation, but I imagine that any vote, whether it's a positive or negative or abstention vote, could in different situations, in fact, sustain their conflict.
Well, Madam Chair, I have to then say that as an astute observer of the process, I've watched legislators walk out of hearings. I've watched them absent themselves from the floor. I've watched them leave the building. Matter of fact, I have left the building right there, rather than vote on an issue that was a difficult issue. And this seems to me to give one more avenue for people to declare a conflict of interest, offer some rationale, and once a person has declared a conflict of interest, whatever rationale they offer, who's going to argue against that? If you declared a conflict, you don't have to vote. It's a very handy mechanism.
Well, I don't think Senator Ferriero, I don't think that's what this bill says.
No. It says you shall refrain from discussing the subject matter, but you shall vote on the issue.
Especially if your vote is necessary for the passage or action on the bill.
All right. Anybody else?
I haven't gotten the emails on 2007.
And what's your explain your conflict.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate you joining us. Professor Watson, you're actually here on 495 as well, right?
I wasn't intending to be.
Okay. All right. Let's bring up Sam Sears then. We're glad you're in the room. Mr. Burson, do you want to add any comments on 595? Come on up. Thank you. I believe I opened a public hearing on both bills, and so we're back on 495.
Chairman and members of the committee, 485 is what we call the nepotism bill, and Sam Sears has carried this bill throughout the interim in the session, and so he'll be explaining what this bill does in terms of codifying existing law and how it changes law.
Thank you. Mr. Sears.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, this is a relatively simple bill, no pun intended. I'd be surprised if it elicited the...
Relatively simple bill, oh boy.
I was thinking about that back there. As
and you've had a lot of time, too. I think you could have come up with something better the last hour.
I'd be surprised if it elicited the types of discussions that came out of the previous bill, because for the simple purpose that this bill, although it's adding new sections to Oregon law, it's generally not changing current practice. Right now, nepotism laws are in force under prohibitions against financial gain of legislators. And those provisions are somewhat confusing if you're just looking at the statutes to see how nepotism fits in. So this bill is just meant to clarify those points, both for the public officials so they can see what the rules are in relation to nepotism, and for the GSBC for enforcement purposes. I really want to highlight three aspects of this bill, the three main points, and that is, one, the basic rule, two, the exceptions to that rule, and then, three, some issues regarding supervision of relatives. The basic rule is pretty simple. It's that public officials can't hire their relatives. For the technical language, you can look at Section 3.1a, and I'll read that. It simply says, a public official may not appoint, employ, or promote a relative or member of the household to a position within the public body of which the public official serves or over which the public official exercises jurisdiction or control. One point that I wanted to make on that is that if you have a public body, it's not precluding a public body from hiring a relative of a public official. It just says that public official can't be the person in charge of hiring. So a public body may still hire the relative of a public official. It's just that somebody else would be appointed with making that decision. The second point I wanted to make are the exceptions to the rule. There are two general exceptions. The first, and this is, again, what the practice has been, is for members of the Legislative Assembly. The main reason for that, I think, for that exception, is that legislators would probably have a hard time hiring people, given the salary that they have, that they could hire if they can hire their own, if they're relatives. I think that's the main justification for having that exception, and this bill keeps that exception alive, with the caveat that, and this was a non-statutory recommendation that the Law Commission made, that the House and the Senate provide rules that members must follow in order to somehow regulate that or provide some kind of rules so that I guess that hiring is not abused, whether that's a certification of hours worked for work done, a maximum and minimum salary, something of that nature. Again, that's not in the statute. That's a non-statutory recommendation, something that you all would have to do through your rules. The second exception, general exception, is that any public official may hire or supervise a relative as an unpaid volunteer. And again, I think that's pretty straightforward. The third point I wanted to make regarding this bill is that it prohibits a public official from directly supervising a relative. That's the general rule, but recognizing that there are many different public bodies in the state, from small to large, in small cities to larger cities and different jurisdictions, this bill allows for a public body to have its own rules in that regard. That means that it can basically set a policy saying, yes, even though there is this public official is supervising a relative, that is still allowed with these exceptions or under these circumstances. So it just gives, basically it just gives smaller jurisdictions or any jurisdiction for that matter leeway to make those rules. With that said, I guess there's one more point I wanted to raise. There is an amendment, the -1 amendment to this bill, and that's not really making a substantive change. It's merely changing the language. As it's written right now, it's saying, if you look at Section 3.1a, it actually says, it's worded that a public official may, you know, appoint, do this or that, if it follows the conflict of interest rules. And I think it's just clear wording. It doesn't really make a difference one way or the other to say a public official may not do these things unless it follows. So I think that's just a change that makes the statute read better. Again, either way, it's not substantive in any regard. and I think it would be a good addition to this bill. With that said, I have no further testimony, and I could take questions if necessary.
Sam, we've had a really interesting conversation today about why the conflict of interest rule should be different or should not be different for the legislature. We've had our ethics laws that the gift ban issue that we worked through that we chose specifically not to treat the legislature, at least the Senate did it differently than other public officials. And so now you're telling us in the hiring of relatives, we are going to treat the legislature differently simply because we have chosen not to give legislators the resources so the only way they can hire people is to hire their spouses or significant others or whatever.
I think so. And again, I think that the basic premise would stand. You know, we start from the premise that officials shouldn't be treated differently, and then really looking, I mean, you really hit it on the head that legislator salaries just don't provide or they're
are not adequate.
Sure.
Okay.
Adequate to maybe hire the type of personnel that they need. So that was one exception that we looked at and said maybe there's some reason for this.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It's a pretty practical one. Yeah. Right, Senator Nelson?
Absolutely.
Okay. Questions for...
and there's a tradition from Eastern Oregon. Bring a spouse.
Mm-hmm. Other comments, questions?
It avoids break other marriages, too.
All right. Senator Mazzarzana, that's a good one. Mr. Burson, any comments you wish to add? Other than you're going to be the enforcer on this one.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ron Burson, Executive Director for Government Standards and Practice. I would just like to say that Senate Bill 495 actually assists the Government Standards and Practices Commission in clarifying its role and giving the agency some direction. I mean, this is, I think it's been pointed out by the members of the committee that this has been a tradition, and we have known this has happened. It's been very difficult for the agency to tie the idea of benefiting financially as a public official to the hiring of relatives in your area. We've spent quite a bit of time and quite a bit of effort in writing numerous opinions that were out there. It's difficult to, the way the current statute's out there, it's very difficult for the agency to enforce these provisions. I think it's just a clear line. We're coming, instead of trying to kind of put all these pieces together to say you can or can't do this, it gives a very clear line. I think also with the small jurisdiction, actually talking about what small jurisdictions do, I think there was a point earlier under the previous bill that I know we don't want to go backwards, but talking about these smaller communities where a person may be in a position where they are hiring or their relatives, it gives a clear line for those folks to follow and not have to try to decipher through the statutes and figure out what they can and cannot do. So this, you know, as an agency, I'm in favor of it because it actually helps our agency inform folks out there what they can and can't do.
Great. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 495? All right. With that, we're going to close the public hearings. I would anticipate if the Senate President's Office allows us to schedule Senate rules sometime next week that we will bring both of these bills back after folks have had an opportunity to caucus on them. I would like to move into work session because I'm a little concerned about losing some of my, I would say, warm bodies, but they're more than warm bodies up here. Let's move up to Senate Bill 951. Marjorie, why don't you remind us about this bill? We do have the -1 amendments.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 951 directs community colleges and other universities to adopt plans to encourage students to register to vote and to vote in those elections. The -1 amendment is coming from Senator Farioli, and it requires that the students receive information about activities relating to voting that are prohibited by law and all of those associated penalties.
Thank you. And Senator Farioli, not that I'm concerned. My understanding is this bill currently does not have a fiscal impact. And I'm just, my only question is, did you review this amendment with the powers that be to determine whether the amendment has a fiscal impact?
Madam Chairman, I don't believe the amendment will affect the cost of the bill administration any more than providing some written material on the penalties and prohibitions against fraud voting in more than one election at one time. And let me, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, I don't think it'll increase the cost. The issue for me was and is that we're being very aggressive about registering new voters, and I think that's a marvelous thing for democracy in Oregon. College students that come into the state from out of state with their registration packets get a registration card and strong encouragement to register as an Oregon voter.
At some universities, that is correct. I don't believe that's true at all universities.
I'll concede that point. Notwithstanding that they're paying out-of-state tuition, they're getting an Oregon voter registration card. They may also be receiving a ballot from home. At the same time, they're getting a ballot from Oregon. It is a felony, Madam Chairman, to vote in the same election in two states as an elector. And I think as long as we're going to encourage those kids to register, we owe them the explanation. If you participate in voter fraud, we'll put it this way. Let's not assume that they will. Here are the penalties for participating in voter fraud. Here's the Oregon law. Here's what's prescribed by the law and the penalties for violating the law. So these kids are intelligent. They're going to get they're here to get a college education. You give them a voter registration card. Ask them to register if they're truly Oregon residents. If they're going to vote in an election in Oregon, they can't vote in the same election in whatever state they're coming from.
And Oregon Student Association, why don't you come on up? Mr. Lindback, come on up for a quick question, please. Hi. Just wanted to touch base, see if you'd seen this amendment and if you have had any conversations with the universities about it.
Sure. Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I did have a chance to look at the amendment before.
And your name for the record.
I'm sorry. Brett Rillette, Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association. And I did have a chance to look over the amendment at the beginning of the committee hearing today. As it's worded, we don't have a problem with it. We have not, though, had a chance to speak with the university system and the community colleges about the amendment. I don't believe it would have a fiscal impact, but I do believe that if the end goal would be to get the information out to voters about what the rules are, the most effective way would be to treat all voters the same. And I believe when your ballots are mailed out, that would be a great opportunity to include with the ballot so that every voter in Oregon has the understanding that they're only able to vote in one election. We do have voters in Oregon that move, and they would potentially do the exact same thing, vote in two counties. So, but as it's worded, we do not have a problem with it.
Thank you. Mr. Lindback, my only concern about this is that I was not aware if there was a little pamphlet or something ready to rock and roll that folks could just put in a packet that goes to students, or whether you thought Mr. Rillette's suggestion about having the information be mailed out at the time of the ballot. Take it away. That's what you get for being here on a Friday afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. We do have various opportunities in which we can educate voters on issues like this. It would not be very difficult for us to assist the colleges in putting together a pamphlet on voter fraud. It would be their expense to print it and distribute to the students, but we could certainly help in the production and the preparation very easily, and I think it's a good idea. I would like to add one subject to that for students, which is how to vote absentee. I think there are a lot of students registering to vote, if they live in Beaverton and then they register to vote in Lane County, for example, when they could remain a Beaverton voter and vote absentee rather than re-registering and declaring their place of voting as Lane County. And so there are various subjects that I think need to be addressed with the education of students and voting, and this bill would, I think, provide the opportunities to do that.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
What we're directing is the community college and state institutions of higher ed to adopt a plan to encourage students to register and vote.
Correct.
And certainly in that plan they could demonstrate how it is that they're going to inform students of the rights, responsibilities, and penalties. So I don't see that it adds any fiscal at all or any burden to this issue, but it would make me a great deal more comfortable as long as we're going to encourage these kids who are coming to the state of Oregon into these higher education institutions to vote, that they get the whole story.
Sir Farrelly, I don't disagree with you. I think you are technically correct, but my guess is that the colleges are going to end up printing an additional pamphlet at their own expense where they actually get the ballots or the registrations for free that they may want to put a fiscal on it. So I'm willing to put the amendment on with the understanding that if it does cause problems, you will work with the sponsors to try and make sure the problems are taken care of. Okay. All right. Any other questions? Everybody happy? All right. Senator Farrelly. Work session on Senate Bill 951.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Farrelly has moved the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 951. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Farrelly.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 951 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Farrelly has moved Senate Bill 951 as amended with the Dash 1 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Oops, excuse me. Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Carrier, you want to carry it?
Honored to, ma'am.
Okay, Senator Farrelly gets to carry. All right, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 951. Open a work session on Senate Memorial 1, and the chair would move this to the Senate floor. Discussion, Senator Farrelly.
Madam Chair, as you know, I have deep reservations about Senate Memorial 1. I have put them on the record. I think that anything that we do in this regard is destined to be deeply misunderstood by Oregonians and families who have children who have been in service to Oregon and America and who have lost those children, or who have families who are in service who are worried about the safe return of those children. But, Madam Chair, if there is a need for a courtesy vote on this bill, I will give it.
Thank you, Senator.
I will oppose this bill on the floor.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly, and I really appreciate you working with this. I think this memorial was truly one of the most collaborative efforts we've seen in the Senate so far. So, thank you. Any other discussion? Krista, would you please call the roll?
Aye. Senator Johnson.
Excused.
Senator Moss Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Nelson.
No.
Chair Brown.
Chair votes aye. Motion carries. Thank you for your courtesy vote, Senator Farrelly, and Senators Devlin and Bates will carry this memorial on the Senate floor. With that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Memorial 1. We're not going to move forward on Senate Bill 125 today. I don't think we have the information that we need. And we're going to open SJR 29. Senator Johnson's not here. I think this is snoozy-lose, unless there's anybody here on SJR 29. Mr. Wasson, are you here on SJR 29? Okay, we're not going to hear that today. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 7-8. Mr. Neely, Mr. Lindback, Mr. Wasson, are you just here for your interests? Okay, all right. Ms. Eaton, you too? You're just here for...
I'm waiting to hear what they're going to say. Now I have something to say.
Oh, the old sit in the back of the room technique.
Be very afraid.
Okay.
78 or something?
Okay.
We're doing 78, is that what?
78. Did I not say that? Yeah, Senate Bill 78. I'm sorry.
Okay, just,
it's Friday.
Who's in la la land?
Well, I think we all are sort of in la la land today. All right. Mr. Neely, Mr. Lindback.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely, and in this instance, I'm representing C&E Systems, which is a company that I own and operate.
And can you speak up a little louder, please?
I can.
Thank you.
And we, C&E Systems, our business in large part is handling contribution and expenditure reports and financial management for political candidates. In front of you are amendments that wholly remove the language of the bill. It's gotten stuff on Senate Bill 78. These amendments have three key features to them. I've handed out written testimony. I'm not going to go into too much detail because I know you guys don't have a lot of time today.
but I will hit the three basic things it does. The first.
And Mr. Neely, you're working off the dash threes.
I'm working. I'm sorry.
Correct.
Yes, the
okay.
dash threes.
Grab the dash threes, everyone. Okay.
And Mr. Lindback, in a moment, is going to talk to you about the dash twos. He may talk about the dash threes three, but
okay.
I'm not going to address the dash twos.
All
I'm
right.
only going to address the dash threes.
Thank you.
The bill does three things. The first thing the bill does is it permits a proxy to file contribution and expenditure reports. As each of you know, last session there were some new campaign finance rules that went into effect. They increased the reporting regularity by a significant amount, and as a result, the treasurers have a significantly higher burden in the work they do. They regularly have to be filing transactional reports. In some instances, the minimum that they're going to file in an active campaign is monthly, but I think most treasurers end up filing much more regularly than monthly. And then within 42 days of the election, it's weekly reporting. So the provision in here that would allow a proxy does just that. It says that someone can actually go into the state electronic filing system and hit the file button that's not the treasurer and that's not the candidate in those instances in which those folks are unavailable, or if as designated by the treasurer or the candidate. The reason for that is laid out in my talking points, and I will tell you briefly that the most important feature, I think, of having a proxy is that it affords the treasurer or the candidate an opportunity to actually get out of town, do those things that they're regularly going to want to do that are difficult to do in instances in which you have to file all the time. So, again, that's item number one. Item number two, this bill will shift the deadline just for those electronic filings from 5 p.m. Currently, the deadline is 5 p.m. on the day it's due. It shifts that to midnight. Again, I think the purpose for doing that is to recognize that what we've created here is a system that's operational 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think that was the intent of the legislature. And as a result, it seems to me a bit arbitrary that we have to file by 5 o'clock when, in fact, we have access to the system at 5:01, at 5:02, at 5:03, and all the way to midnight. Again, we're not saying extend the period of time in terms of days beyond where we're already at. What we're saying is it's prudent to recognize that we are in a where the system operates in a 24-hour cycle, 7 days a week. Let's adjust the law to allow us to do that too. And I'll talk. The other piece of it that is important, I think, to recognize here is, oftentimes those folks who are filing are either volunteers or they're candidates. And in fact, it's very difficult for them in the course of their daily operations to file at 5 o'clock or between the normal hours of 8 and 5. And because of that, we find ourselves in our business place contacting candidates and the treasurers regularly after 5, or we contact them before 5, and their response is, well, I'm happy to do it, but I'm at work. I can't do it on my work computer, or I'm in the legislature. I can't do it on my public computer. Let me wait till I get home after 5 o'clock and do that. So this addresses those difficult situations, again, without providing any significant increases in time to the filing. Again, you're still operating under the 7-day deadline. And the final piece I call a quasi-technical fix. It right now, under current Oregon law, from January 1st until the start of session, all of the contributions that are received in that period of time need to be reported within 48 hours. That dates back to when you guys had an express prohibition against contributions. That's obviously been tossed by the court, by the Supreme Court. Again, this seems to me to be a little bit arbitrary. What we're asking for is that all the contributions get reported within the first 48 hours of session starting. We're still going to know all the contributions that come in before session. And frankly, I've talked to Ms. Thompson in the course of crafting these amendments, and we might, depending on what happens in the other chamber, if we can get out of this one, we might actually extend that back a little bit and say, because right now it would only be those contributions that come in between the first and the first day of session that have to be reported within 48 hours. Let's go back and catch any contribution that hasn't yet been reported, make that reported within the first 48 hours. I think that was really the spirit of the law when you guys adopted the law. Okay. And this was just an oversight that dates back to that time because this provision was somewhere else.
Okay.
So again, that's a basic overview in about 5 minutes of what this does. And the most important piece, as I said, is that proxy piece right now. We are having a very difficult time with all the campaigns we work on keeping the treasurer on board because it is so onerous. I can tell you that right now we have 4 campaigns we're working on that are under the 7-day reporting rule. And you'll find when you folks get there in your own campaigns, it is a heck of a lot of work. We're calling those treasurers once, twice a day, interrupting their normal work patterns. And fortunately, in each of these campaigns, we have retirees. But I think that's fundamentally what might end up happening is the only people that can interrupt their days and with that sort of regularity are people who are retired or who have such a flexible work schedule that they can go ahead and submit filings anytime. With that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Neely, just for the committee members' background and information, these proposals come out of a small work group that you and I and Senator Farioli and your Republican Republican counterpart participated in. Isn't that correct?
That is absolutely correct, Chair Brown. Thank you very much for reminding me of that. And again, I've talked to people on both sides of the aisles. We all agree that this will help facilitate recruitment and retaining of treasurers because, again, the burden is very high. And I would add one last piece. There's still the responsibility, if there's a mistake, still is squarely on the shoulders of the treasurer and the candidate in those instances in which a mistake is made.
Okay. Mr. Lindback.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. John Lindback, Director of Elections. We are fine with the -3 amendments. I just wanted to point out one additional provision that's in these amendments that Mr. Neely didn't mention, and that is the provision that a candidate or treasurer may designate a person to receive any notice. This is an extra person, any notice provided by a filing officer, and this is to resolve a problem where some committees have asked that a second person, non-candidate committees, be given notice of penalties and problems.
Great.
And we're fine with that as well.
Great. So you're okay with the -3 amendments, but you'd like an additional amendment.
I would like an additional amendment. Those are in the -2s.
Okay.
And let me just explain to you where this is coming from. We didn't propose this at the beginning of the session because I was unaware at the time of the legislature's interest in trying to prevent identity theft and that would be an emphasis this session. I have had a concern about identity theft with regards to voter registration records, and it relates to the fees that we charge for people to receive information from our new centralized voter registration system. We have adopted a rule that sets these fees, and the rule is that any individual that wants to purchase information data from the voter registration system pays 2.5 cents for every 100 voters, and that gives you the information, all the information on a person's voter registration card except their signature. And it tops out that if that fee gets up to $500, it stops there. And the practical effect of that is that to get a statewide voter registration list, it costs $500. I have been challenged by an individual who does not believe that this charge is legal under the provision in state law that says we're only allowed to charge, base our charges on the actual cost of us producing a report from the system. We have stuck with the fee, but I believe we're potentially legally vulnerable on that, partially because our vendor who helped us develop the centralized voter registration system is unable to isolate what the actual cost is to produce such a report. Therefore, that statute is not of much guidance. My concern is that if we should get challenged on this legally, we would have to potentially charge a very small amount for the entire voter registration list,
which I think would make a lot of people uncomfortable with regards to the increasing the potential for identity theft. So therefore, what the Dash 2 amendments does is it moves that $500 fee for a copy of the statewide voter registration list into statute, which takes it out from under that other statute that says that we can only charge based on what the actual cost is.
Okay. Questions? All right. Anybody else wishing to testify on the Dash 2s or the Dash 3s amendments to Senate Bill 7-8? Okay. Committee's pleasure. You guys ready? All right. Does somebody want to call Senator Farioli? That'd be great. We're going to move into work session on Senate Bill 78. Sarah Nelson.
I would move the dash. Do you want them individually?
Let's do them individually.
To Senate Bill 78.
Which one?
Dash 2. Senator Nelson has moved the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 78.
I have discussion?
Yeah.
I have the Dash 1s. They're not anything?
No.
Okay.
I assume they're a first version.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
I don't know where I got that from, but just because they were number one, I assume they were recycled, to be recycled. We're discussing the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 78.
Is that where the proxy does the time, Madam Chairman?
No, that's the Dash 3.
That's where the Secretary of State can charge a fee to deliver the statewide list of electors, and the fee is probably more than the actual cost, but they are trying to discourage folks from gathering that information to avoid use as in identity theft cases. So, discussion? We'll give you a minute.
Proceed, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I've seen no further discussion. Would you please call the roll?
Madam Chair, I suggest going to do this without objection.
Okay. All right. Great. Any objection to the Dash 2s? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Nelson.
I would move the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 78.
The Senator Nelson has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 78. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Nelson.
I would move Senate Bill 78 as amended by Dash 2s and Dash 3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Nelson has moved the Dash Senate Bill 78 as amended by the Dash 2s and 3s to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Would you like to carry?
Sure.
Okay. That'd be great. I think, unless I need to take a minute on Senate Bill 125, that we are done for the day. We're done for the day. All right. Anything further to come before the business committee? Hopefully, we will have an opportunity to meet next week. Thank you for your courtesies. Please drive carefully and have a delightful weekend. It will probably be your last one. Mm-hmm. That's that right. We're adjourned.
Delightful weekend, Madam Chair.